On our morning show today from WRCO, we have author John Armbruster in the studio with us. A community read and author presentation is coming up at the Brewer Public Library Saturday at 10, featuring Tailspin, the story of the World War II tail gunner from Soldier's Grove, Gene Moran, who fell 4 miles in a severed plane tail and lived. That's just amazing in itself, and the amazing part is that he grew up here right in our listening area. John, we appreciate you taking the time to make the trip down here today.
Thanks, Phil, for inviting me.
Great to have you in here today. Let's take it back a little bit. Were you always a World War II buff?
Yes. I was one of those geeks in school that always had a history book in my hand, often World War II. I remember I was in third grade when I got my first grown-up book, and it was coincidentally about flying fortresses. And it a love that never went away and formed, I think, my career. I was just recently retired after 32 years of teaching social studies. And so I was always a history buff.
Yeah, and were you able to kind of give some of those stories to your students? I mean, do they appreciate some of the things?
The stories from Tailspin?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've used Tailspin quite often since Gene and I started working on the book in 2011, bits and pieces of it and pictures of it. So, yeah, I've been able to incorporate it into my lesson plans.
When did you decide to incorporate what was going on in your life at the same time as Gene's story? Because I think it started out just as a story about Gene, didn't it?
Right. Well, I first heard of Gene's story in October of 1994. I just got hired at North Crawford. It was my first full-time social studies teaching job. And just by coincidence, and I mentioned this in the book, I just overheard a conversation. It was during an in-service day. Some teachers talking about a guy that fell 4 miles, you know, and lived in that school district. And I had just been in this area for a month. This was 30 years ago. And I could not have heard that, right? That doesn't make any sense. But his daughter taught at North Crawford Schools, and her room was right next to mine. And of course, I was this overly enthusiastic history teacher. I'm like, oh my God, we got to have your dad come to my classroom, and I want to hear all about this. And I was a big World War II buff, and she said, absolutely not. We don't talk about it in our family. And long story short, I got to know the family very well. Gene became a family friend, and they approached me and one of the daughters about writing his story in 2010. And at first, I said no. I told them, I said, you need a real author. And I felt woefully underqualified. And a few months later, she came back to me and said, Dad has agreed to a book. And I'm like, great, who's your author? And she looked at me, you are. And I said, no. I said, absolutely, this is the beginning of a new school year. And she just said, Dad won't write it unless you write it. And Gene had become, my wife and Gene were close. And both my late wife and I, we lost our fathers early. So Gene was kind of like a surrogate grandfather to my two young boys. And Gene came to their birthday parties and first communion. So he kind of became part of the family. But even then I said no. And it was actually the advice of another well-known author to this area. I'm sure many listeners will recognize the name Ben Logan, whom I got to know. And like I always tell people, I shamelessly name drop him every chance I get. But when he bought his home farm back, it was in the North Crawford School District, and I got to know him as I was teaching. And he gave me advice and inspired me. And Gene and I started in January 2011 and we worked together for 3 years on his book before he died.
I mentioned to you before we went on the air, it was kind of like peeling an onion away, though, mm-hmm. wasn't it? Trying to get to the layers.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when Ben Logan gave me advice, and sadly, it was the last time I saw Ben Logan. He was in a nursing home at the time, but he advised me to, you know, talk about growing up farming in Southwest Wisconsin. Now, I grew up working on farms in Central Wisconsin, and it's all flat up there. I can't imagine, you know, haying, picking rock, chopping down, clearing woods in Ridge and Valley country down here, and it's very difficult. So he said, you know, Ben said to talk about dairy farming, talk about baseball. He loved baseball, and baseball was such a big deal in the 30s and 40s and 50s around here. And then slowly, as you said, peeling an onion, get to the war later. And if you come to a tough topic, stop, back off. I bet he comes back to it. So, and we did. And there were some very difficult moments, and I recount some of those in the book. And at times I'm wondering, why are we doing this? We're just making this old man suffer. But Gene never gave up. In fact, I interviewed him. Our last interview was 2 weeks before he died. So we were working right up until the end.
there's a reason they call that generation the greatest generation, isn't there?
And that, you know, it's funny, as a history teacher and doing graduate work later on, I did stuff on World War II and that generation. I think some people, it was almost this reaction. Some people got a little bit tired of hearing that all the time. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They lived through the Depression. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They survived World War II. But there truly was something unique. And Gene, too, never said they were a better generation. He never, ever got on a soapbox and said, oh, kids these days, or this country's going to hell in a handbasket. He never did that. But they truly did live through very unique times. They, you know, they survived the Depression. And I think surviving as a dairy farm kid through the Depression explains why he survived his horrible experiences. And when they came home from World War II, they wanted to get back with their lives. They just wanted to normalize and raise families. And they didn't call themselves the greatest generation, but they were truly unique times.
I can't imagine, though, you know, he was pretty comfortable on the farm. Yeah, there were long hours. I know he was hauling milk and doing all those things. But to leave that and want to go into the war so badly that he even forged his parents' signatures.
He did, yes.
I just can't fathom that.
No, I mean, it was a different time, too. I remember what Ben Logan told me about. He, too, was very enthusiastic about joining World War II. But he admitted to my students, he said, you know, I would have felt differently about Vietnam. So it was a different area and a different mission at that time. And people, you know, look at Gene a lot of times like, oh, what a great patriot, what a great American. And in all honesty, he joined the war because he wanted to get off the farm. He just said, I was so sick of dairy farming. One of his better friends, a main character of the book and a native of this area, Bear Valley and Richland Center, was the same way. They dreamed about getting, you know, they talked about escaping to the city. And when the war started, I was shocked when Gene told me about the day Pearl Harbor was attacked. He was 17. He said he was happy. He smiled. He said, I knew that punched my ticket off the farm. He said he counted the days until his 18th birthday. And on his 18th, very day of his 18th birthday, he went to Madison to sign up with the Army Air Corps. Of course, with the Army Air Corps, you had to be 21 to sign for the Army Air Corps or have parent permission. That's why he had to forge his parents' signature to get in. But he was just, I mean, he was looking for adventure. You know, he wanted to get off the farm. There's this great mission out there, and he wanted to join it. Of course, he had no idea what he was getting into, the dangers.
Speaking of dangers, too, and I don't know if I'll get this right, but when he was with the Air Fortress, 1 in 3 completed all 25 missions that they were assigned for.
Right.
So the other 2 planes didn't make it or were captured.
Absolutely. Gene went there in 1943, which at a time the air war was not going very well. He joined the famed the 8th Air Force. He was assigned to that in England. Right now, of which there's a series on Apple TV called Masters of the Air that's running that recounts that story. And Gene got there and he said when he first got there, he was showering with a guy on his airbase that was lucky enough to have his 25 completed. And he said, you know, for most of you guys, it's not if, but when. And yeah, they were required to complete 25 of these missions. 25 may not seem like a lot, but when you understand all that went into just one mission, you do one and you're like, you're done for the rest of your life. You've seen enough adventure for the rest of your life. The stress to do that 25 times was incredible. And yeah, when Gene, it did get better toward the end of the war. But in 43, the air war was not going well. The losses were terrible. They almost thought about suspending that bomber campaign because they were losing so many crews and they couldn't replace them fast enough. In fact, when Gene got there in October of 1943, he usually had a couple weeks to acclimate a few training flights over England. Gene got there October 28th, 29th, and on November 3rd, he was flying his first mission. There was just no downtime to get these guys ready. They threw him into the fire right away.
Sped it up, that's for sure. But the other thing was they would go out on missions, but maybe if they didn't drop the bomb or they were called back, they were still fighting to get back, but it wasn't considered a mission.
You had to drop your bombs on a primary target or secondary target for the mission to be counted. And Gene, I remember one time, talked about fighting all the way in. Couldn't find their target, couldn't find the secondary target, came back, and they didn't get credit for that. Boy, and that was something that angered him many years later because you put your life on the line and then did not get credit for it.
The other thing that struck me was another plane took off. I believe they were 3rd in line,
yep.
And it crashed,
yep.
And they just bulldozed it over and then kept on going.
I mean, life is so cheap. You know, these guys were expendable. And I've been inside one of these flying fortresses. I've flown in one at the Oshkosh Air Show. There's no creature comforts. There's sharp edges everywhere. And then with that story that you just recounted, yeah, they were 3rd in line on a mission. And one pilot, for some reason, pulled up. You know, there was a balance, a trick to getting these very heavily loaded planes off the ground. And he pulled up too quickly and it stalled. Crashed right at the edge of the airfield. There was nothing left. It just obliterated. 10 men gone. They bulldozed it. The other plane took off in front of him, went through the smoke. And then Gene's plane had a front review of it. They went back to their tarmac to wait and then came back to complete the mission. He said he could remember going over the part that they just bulldozed because it vibrated. And 10 men gone just like that, you know, here today, gone tomorrow. That was the attitude in late 43.
Unbelievable. And then, of course, the mission that took place where his severed tail of his plane and he falls. I mean, how does anyone survive that?
You know, I've been to the exact spot where he fell. The Germans know the story very well over there. On the 75th anniversary in 2018, the city where his plane crashed and exploded invited over 30 of us, and it was financed by a wealthy German man, to celebrate the 75th anniversary, which we found odd, but it turned out to be a wonderful ceremony and a wonderful ending to my book. But when we got there, I was expecting, you know, this was northwestern Germany, and I didn't know the geography very well. I was expecting, like, you know, mountains, hillsides with big, bushy pine trees, something that would explain cushioning his landing. But when I got there, it looked very much like my home area of Marshfield, Wisconsin. Flat, small, marshy woods, agricultural. And we got to the woods, and when they showed us the spot, I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. It was just spindly trees, and it had been a forest since the war, an alfalfa field about 20 yards from where Gene fell. And I remember there was a television crew there, a German television news crew, that was filming our 4 days there. And they said, well, you're the author. Explain how he lived. What did Gene say? I'm like, I have no idea. I can't tell you. And I didn't try writing that in the book. You know, he crashed, he crawls out of the wreckage, and that's it. I can't explain how he lived. And some people have asked too, well, did he float down? Did it kind of glide down? No, he fell very quickly. It's wreckage. And imagine driving a car off the cliff of Grand Canyon. You see how that turns out for you. He said he fell so fast that his teeth fillings popped out and blood rushed into his eyes from the G-forces. He was blinded for several days. But he said he was conscious all the way down, but he knew he was falling very, very fast. And when he fell, he just accepted death. He just said, why fight it? And when he first got out of the plane, and I don't know if I did mention this in the book, he started laughing because he had cheated death. He actually started laughing once he got on the ground. At first, he thought he was dead. You know, he's crawling toward the light. He thought mm-hmm. he was dead.
Right.
But when he got out, he was in a woods. He said when he could feel that cold November air and then he was grabbing some leaves and dirt, he knew he was alive. And he just started chuckling to himself until he felt his head wound, which was a cranial gash, leaving his brain wide open. He could feel his brain. It was that exposed. And yeah, it's how he lived. It's just, he had more lives than a cat.
There were people that witnessed it though, yep. that saw it, saw him fall, yep. right?
They were French POWs. And I often, when I do my presentations and like I have that one at the Brewer Library this mm-hmm. Saturday.
That's right.
I always have to, people get confused about that. So he crashed in northwestern Germany, but there was a POW camp nearby. And what I found out, and I visited that POW camp, it's now a museum, and the archivist said what the Germans would do, they would let the French out to scrounge for food. Now, in 43, France is conquered by Germany. They're not really an escape risk because where are they going to go? Western Europe's under the Nazi jackboot. So they would let the French, under armed guard, go out and scrounge for food. And what they learned to do is go after the wreckage of downed American planes because there's all kinds of goodies on those planes. The Americans carried Hershey bars in their survival pack. They would also rip off their throat mics because they'd grab the wires and they'd make homemade radios out of them. So there are all kinds of goodies on those planes that the French. So when they watched Gene, and he learned this later through translators, and the French themselves told him later, "This, we watched you fall." And they just waited, and then they ran to the woods, and they saw Gene lying on the ground. But Gene said, "Now he could only make out 4 to 5 guys and shapes of their bodies because he had blood in his eyes." But he said, "Yeah, they started tearing him apart, and then they just freaked out when he started talking to them because they thought he was dead."
And the other thing that interested me too, and I didn't realize this, but he was lucky to be found by them and then German guards or whatever, yep. Because had it been civilians in Germany, they probably would have killed him, right?
Yeah, that was very common. And Gene had heard about that back at the airbase. They were told, you know, your first duty is to bury your parachute, and then there's a resistance system you try to get in contact with to maybe ferry you back to England or get through Spain to try and escape. Once Gene was lying on the ground and felt his open head wound, he knew he wasn't going anywhere. But he knew that his odds, ironically, that if the German military catches you, your odds are much better of surviving. If civilians catch you, they're more than likely will kill you. I mean, there were always stories of farmers running pitchforks through them or just shooting you with their shotguns and leaving you. The Germans were so embittered at the British and American flyers. I mean, the Americans tried precision daylight bombing. They tried to hit industrial military targets, but their bombs missed all the time. And so many German civilians were killed. I remember Gene saying, too, he found that the women were particularly vengeful because he was almost killed when the Germans found him. It was the German army that found him, threw him on an ox cart, and when they're parading him through town to take him to the POW camp, he was attacked by a mob, and he was almost killed. But he remembers this, just, he said, the vengeful, shrill screams of the women that wanted to kill him.
When he was at the POW camp, it was no Hogan's Heroes, was it?
No. It was, he was at three different POW camps, and each one was a little bit different. The first one, he was almost treated like a celebrity. There was quite an international camp. All different types of people were there. He said even German soldiers will sometimes peek their head into his barracks just to say, you know, is that him? Is that the guy that fell? He kind of, and the French just thought he was this. They just loved him. And then he went to Stalag Luft 6, which was in Lithuania, which was not a great camp, but it wasn't abusive. It was his third camp that was really rough, that had an abusive commander. And by that time, food and supplies had gotten so low at the end of the war. Disease was rampant. Food was low. Men were starving. And then he had that horrible death march at the end of the war that he had to endure. So, yeah, it progressively got worse.
I had thoughts, though, of a couple of Hollywood things. One was the story about where they were digging in the latrine and they were giving him dirt in his pants to take out and let go. I think that's in a movie called The Great Escape.
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like some of these episodes, people might recognize this stuff from other books or other World War II movies, but it really did happen. And Gene was determined in Stalag Luft 6, they had an escape committee. He was not one that was going to be selected to try and escape. His wounds were so great, but he still wanted to help. So he served as a lookout a lot, or sometimes would carry dirt in his pants too. And yeah, they would go through a toilet trying to dig tunnels. But that tunnel project was never completed because the Russians were coming and they were transferred to another camp.
Yeah. And then, as you mentioned, it just got worse and worse. It's like, how much can one man endure, you know, just when you think that maybe you've made it.
Right. He survived his fall, and then he survived an attack by a mob. And then he's got this horrible head wound and many other busted bones from that fall, and survives surgery in that first POW camp. Something that I think people forget, surviving boredom and fatigue and just malnutrition. Boredom was a real killer in these POW camps. And I think the thing that people forget is if you're an inmate at a prison, you know how many days you have left. You know what you've been sentenced to. But a POW doesn't know that. And they have no idea how long they're going to be there. And they're not getting any news. They get some rumors from new prison inmates. That not knowing can be debilitating and would drive people nuts. They called it barbed wire disease. And I think one advantage Gene had is growing up in Southwest Wisconsin on a dairy farm that did not get electricity until 1940. He was used to long nights. He was used to going without. Didn't bother him as much. He noticed that city kids, and not to, you know, to disparage city kids, but he said they had a much more difficult time with the boredom, the lights out, the long winter nights. So I think his rural upbringing served him well in POW camp.
There was a little luck involved, though, along the way for him,
absolutely,
too.
Absolutely.
Obviously, it wasn't all bad. I mean, and you mentioned the tie to Richland Center area, Bear Valley. Bill Dorgan was a good friend, and he saw him
Yes. Gene and Bill got to know each other before the war in Gene's milk row. Bill Dorgan was also a dairy farm kid and just looking to escape dairy farm life. And they became friends before the war, and then Gene went to war, and they just lost touch. And the next time he sees Bill Dorgan is at that POW camp, Stalag Luft 6, in which is now Lithuania. What Gene would do is the old prisoners would always come to the main gate to see the new batch come in, to see, and they'd shout out their state names, you know, and maybe by chance recognize someone or have some kind of local connection. And son of a gun, here comes Bill Dorgan from Richland Center, Bear Valley area, through the door, and Gene was like, "What in the heck are you doing here?" And Bill Dorgan was also a bomber gunner that got shot down, and he was actually in pretty rough shape. He had a broken leg that was never set right and was starving. And Bill, a Richland Center native, becomes an important part of the story.
I guess perseverance is a word that comes to mind, but also just the ability to, I guess one of the things that struck me was he was being interviewed about going home. You know, because his injuries were bad enough.
Yes.
And it seemed to me, the way you described it, he kind of downplayed it a little bit.
Yeah, so that's another aspect I didn't know until I began research. So through the Red Cross, the Germans did repatriate. They did do some prisoner exchanges in 1944. And it was these prisoners were always in this status of limbo. And a lot of it came directly from the top, from Hitler. Hitler went back and forth. He thought at times about just simply murdering them all. And we know what the Third Reich is doing to many people in Europe, so this would not have been unfathomable. Then there was talk, well, I might use them as bargaining chips in as some type of negotiated settlement. And there'd be times he'd order, that's it, have them all killed. And Gene always said that was the worst part. You didn't know what was going to happen to us. But many Luftwaffe, German Air Force senior officers, did not want these guys killed because certainly there were many downflyers in England and they worried about retribution. But it was always a status of not knowing until he was finally liberated by Americans in April of 1945.
If it would have been me, I would have been, my back's killing me.
He was on the list, like, to be repatriated. But, Gene was, he kind of downplayed his injuries. He's like, no, I mean, the head wound gave him horrible headaches, but in a selfless act, he just felt there were others, a couple others that should go before him, and they were horribly wounded. And that is how the story got back to America. In 1944, there was a POW that was repatriated, exchanged. And when he got to New York in the summer of 1944, he told a story, Gene's story, to the Associated Press. Well, the Associated Press picked it up, and it was all over the country. His mom had got newspapers sent to him from St. Paul, Baltimore, New York, all over the country, they get newspapers. So the story was out in 1944.
Yeah, he was kind of a star and didn't know it, right?
Had no idea. In fact, he was upset with the guy that shared that story. He did not want his family knowing about his injuries or about his fall. What he didn't know is they already knew. And I have I have the original postcard that the German prison camps would allow them to write home, letting them know they were alive. He always downplayed his injuries. Everything was fine. But his family knew just how bad it was.
He was a humble man, wasn't he?
Yeah, and I think there's a certain humility and a certain stubbornness when you're 19 and 20 years old. And that's kind of the make of his personality. It was just in him never to give up. He just always had this belief that, I'm going to make it. I think, too, dairy farming in Richland Valley country. He spent many hours alone behind horses, cutting hay and pitching hay, hard work, Didn't, like he said, we didn't have a dime to our name during the Depression. His ability to find food when none was to be had was something the other prisoners picked up on, too. It's like, oh, Gene Moran can find food anywhere. And, he was not above eating rats in prison or dead birds. So he just had a survivor mentality he had his whole life.
We think about soldiers, men and women coming back now and, suffering from PTSD and all of the things that they go through. I think there weren't probably as many things available to soldiers coming back at that era.
No, what struck me, too, was Gene's health care. I mean, he was actually issued a permission slip prescription to drink whiskey on the troop train when he got home. That was how they just wanted you drink, cover it up. He had permission to get a bottle of Southern Comfort to drink while in uniform, while on his troop trains after the war when he was having his evaluations. And the one doctor that sat him down and said, you know, I'm going to be honest with you. Do not get married or have kids. He said, you're probably going to be dead in 10 years. You'll either kill yourself or drink yourself to death. Typical Gene, he was married 3 months later and had 9 kids. So he wasn't listening to anybody. But yeah, it was, but admittedly, he struggled his whole life. And, you know, I don't think it's, I shame him by saying he told me, you know, he struggled with alcohol. He said sometimes it worked and sometimes it did not. And it wasn't until late in his life, I think, where he really finally started controlling his demons and starting relaxing a little bit. He really, he had a lot of problems with seizures, meltdowns, too much drinking throughout his life. I don't think he found peace until later in life.
His children didn't know probably any of the story, did they?
No, I mean, they knew. Everyone knew of the basic story, and that's what I learned when I first came to Soldiers Grove in 1994. He fell, he survived, and he was a POW. That's it. And I'd even hear whispers from town people. It's like, oh no, you don't ever bring the story up. Don't ask him directly. He won't talk about it. So he just sat on it for years. And it wasn't until 2007, former Congressman Ron Kind. He always did these veterans oral history projects. Gene agreed to that, but I went to that interview up at the La Crosse Airport, and Ron Kind was nice enough to come to my book launch, and we talked about that interview, and he said, yeah, that was a tough one. Gene kind of ended it, but they did bring in a Flying Fortress from Oshkosh, and he wrote on that, and I remember when he got out of the plane, he said, you know, the reporters were coming up to him, and he was on television that night, and he said, that's the last time I ever do that, and he wasn't just talking about a plane ride, so we thought the story was done. But some family members and Legion friends of his kind of pestered him, and he agreed to do a book, but only if I did it. And I had no idea what I was getting myself into in 2010.
Now it's worked out well. We'll talk about the success of Tailspin and more coming up here on The Morning Show when we continue. Again, the community read at the Brewer Public Library with our guest, John Brister, is coming up on Saturday, and that will be at 10 o'clock at the library. John Armbruster is our guest on The Morning Show today, talking about the book Tailspin, which I've read, and it's a wonderful read. Really enjoy it. Wanted to mention just a few things, like 6 degrees of separation with Gene for me, which is really interesting. So his mission in which his plane was severed and he fell was 11/29/43. Mm-hmm. That was my birthday 20 years later.
Oh, my God.
So I was born November 29th, exactly 20 years to the day later.
Oh, wow.
The other thing, there was, you mentioned Gene's brother married a Murphy.
Yes.
And I go to the Murphy reunions, or I'm invited every year to Rolling Ground, so I'm sure there's some relative there. St. Philip's Church, my parents were married there. And my sister showed me this. I think I told you before I went on the air, but she said, is this Uncle John? And I said, it sure is. So there's a baseball picture of a baseball team from Soldiers Grove, and Uncle John is right there by Gene. So I've got a lot of tie-ins there.
Oh, yeah. St. Philip's is a central theme in Gene's life. He was baptized there, and he was buried there. Mm-hmm. So it's really, and my God, you can't swing a dead cat in that cemetery without hitting an Irish name. It's Murphys and Morans and O'Connells and...
Sure.
And it's amazing. It's really there's quite a settlement of Irish Americans in that area of Soldiers Grove.
It's been amazing and maybe somewhat overwhelming for you, some of these appearances that you've made, that there's this much interest, John.
Yeah, we were talking before we started the interview. Let's see. I'm trying to think. I had a presentation last night. Verroca was my 85th appearance. About 55 of those have been presentations, and then the rest have been signings and a bunch of school talks, but I've got another 20 this year, so I'll be over 100 appearances, most in the state of Wisconsin. I do have a few in Minnesota, and I have one in Nebraska this spring, but I've been taken aback by this too, and I have people come up to me all the time. They're like, did you have any idea? I'm like, no, I wanted to give up on this story. My editor pushed me, and I've been overwhelmed by the response of this story, particularly in the state of Wisconsin.
So let's talk a little bit about the tie-in with your personal life. Mm-hmm. You know, was it therapeutic to talk about your wife, Carmen, and, you know, what was going on in your life at the same time you were trying to write this book?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think That's still a tough one to answer. To be determined, I guess. And for your listeners, so there, a lot of people wonder, like, what does this have to do with my wife? In that, so when I met my editor, who is really my coach, I think of, you know, she was the Lombardi of Tailspin, you know, and I'm the Bart Starr, like, okay, you know, it's, I will do what you tell me. And so we're putting the book together, and obviously I wanted to write it as a narrative, much like the book Unbroken. I was impressed with that style of storytelling. But my editor said, you know, this Gene is quite a character. And he was a funny guy and a comical guy. And I want him as an old man. And I'm like, okay, like a Tuesdays with Maury. I interviewed Gene on Thursdays. We called it Thursdays with Gene. And so I thought, yeah, okay, I can do this. It was getting more complex. But then she said, as we were talking about at break, we're putting the book together, the blueprint. And she said, now, wait a minute, your wife died in the middle of all this. And I said, yes. And Gene and your wife were close. I said, yes, they were good friends. Gene was a notorious flirt, to be honest with you. And she said, well, we as a reader have to know that story too. And at first I was like, no, absolutely not. I said, I've lived it. I'm not going to write that. And my editor always had a way, well, I'll let you think about it, which was her way of saying, we're going to do this and somehow I'll find a way. And at first when, so yes, during the 3 years that Gene and I worked together, my wife is fighting cancer and she lost. And in the middle of this, so Gene and I were about a year and a half into our work together when she died. And at that point, I'm thinking there's not going to be a book. I will finish up what I have with Gene, and I'll just hand it off to the family and they can do with the story whatever they want. But when I met my editor at a Madison writing conference, she's like, this is an amazing story. You have to go on. And so we incorporated my wife's story into this, and you know, and then Gene died a year and a half after Carm died. It was difficult, obviously. And I would send drafts to my editor, and she'd be blunt and say, this is boring, you're not into this, you know. And so I remember one time I said, all right, if you want to know what it's like, I will let you know what it's like. So I wrote a couple chapters in just pure rage. I didn't care about grammar, I didn't care about word choice. I just ripped it off and sent it to her, and she sent it back to me and said the rough drafts. And she said, well, this needs work, she said, but I will say, you had me bawling three times, you're finally becoming a writer. So what I learned was that you have to let go. You can't do these emotional, difficult stories halfway. And I think the same thing it was with Gene. I always did. We had some tough interviews, you know, where it became very emotional. And there are times I thought, is this worth it? Why are we torturing this old man? He's in his 80s, late 80s. Why are we doing this? But he didn't give up. He kept going. We'd take breaks now and then, but he'd come back to it. So, yeah, you just have to keep going on to get the story out.
Yeah, you were kind of drudging up some things that he didn't want to talk about. But
No, and I think there always were people, I get that question a lot at my presentation. You think anything, Gene left anything out? And I'd say yes. There would be times. I remember when I came to the topic of the hell ship, that was that ship that transferred from one prison to another. And I've done enough research on that, that it was just a horrible but underreported incident of World War II. I remember he ended the interview and abruptly had me leave. He came up with some excuse. He had to be somewhere. I'm like, this is odd, but I figured it out. He didn't want to talk about this. He did come back to it. But I think about the death march he endured at the end of the war. There was just so much. There was just death everywhere. And it wasn't just servicemen or Allied POWs. There were refugees that were trying to escape the Russian onslaught from the east. And there were Poles and Germans and Ukrainians and every nationality and language you could think of. Every age, and just the most pathetic people. And there's just people are starving and they're murdered and they'd get strafed by Allied planes. And there's just death everywhere. He kept a lot of those stories. I wanted to know, you know, was there anyone in particular? What did you see? I remember I didn't get very far with those stories. I think there's a lot of images from the death march he kept to himself.
When you first met him, was it like meeting a rock star, a movie star or something?
You know, I know I first met him it was right after his wife, when his first wife died, Peg, in 2003, I went to the funeral and I'd met him. And then after that, Gene's a single man for a little while. He remarried at age 84. That tells you something about Gene. But Joni, his daughter Joni, and my wife became good friends, and we just often get together for bonfires and birthday parties and suppers. And I remember sitting down one time watching a Packer game with Gene, and we talk about hunting and baseball and football. But I remember one time looking at his hands, I'm like, my God, those hands operated a 50 caliber machine gun and shot at Nazi fighter pilots. And I'm this war geek wanting to know the story, but I was told you don't go there. I did not ask him about it the several years I knew him prior, never mentioned it, never brought it up, until we finally decided to talk about the book in December 2010. And that first time didn't go very well because it looked like he was going to back out of the project. But then January 2011, we started, and he didn't look back.
He was kind of broken up too, right? His arms were injured.
Yeah, I remember, you know, when I sat down with him, he was always self-conscious about his wounds. He wore a baseball cap a lot to cover up his head scar. And I remember the first time sitting down too, when it was for the very first interview, he had his hat off, and I saw the scar on his head, and it threw me a bit. Not only that, my wife had a head scar from the surgery she had, so I'm kind of mixed up at that point, and I'm trying not to look at his head scar. And then I remember looking at his forearm. His right forearm was kind of bent at an awkward angle. In the air battle, before he fell, he was shot through both arms. And he said one snapped right. The bone snapped right through his leather jacket, and he said he stared at it a moment. Bone came right through, a compound fracture right through his leather jacket. And he did his first POW camp. There were the Serbian doctors there that fixed him up as best he could, but that right forearm never healed quite properly. So yeah, he had a bent right forearm for the rest of his life, which kind of ended his baseball playing days, other than managing an occasional pinch hitting for the local teams around here. But and then his back bothered him most of his life too. He had some vertebrae that were cracked in his back. But and of course the head wound gave him seizures for many, many years. So yeah, he had lifelong disabilities.
What would he think if he were alive now and heard about the success of the book? What would he say?
You know what? That's a great question. And I can only speculate. He was a man that had such a hard life, but yet he loved life. You know, everywhere I go, I remember doing a speech up at Manitouish Waters on the border of Upper Michigan, and someone knew him, and he was the life of the State Legion conventions, I guess. He knew how to party. He knew how to have a good time. And I don't know. He was getting attention before he died. I remember his son, Pat, took him to an honor flight to Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And this isn't in the book, but it's one of the funniest stories about him. He went to Washington, D.C. Some of the people out there knew his story. And at the end of the day, they went and got a drink at a bar somewhere. And the bartender started asking him questions. Oh, you're the guy that fell 4 miles or something like that. And he goes, tell me about it. And Gene was long day. He was tired. He's like, just Google me. You know? I think he'd be okay with the attention, but it'd be quite overwhelming at this point because the crowds at my presentations are pretty big. And oh my God, to see Gene would just be, it'd be unreal.
Mm. You mentioned the book and the movie Unbroken, and that was a Japanese prison, if I remember
right. Yes.
And that was a successful book and movie. What about your story? I'm guessing you've been asked this before.
Yeah, I have. And so if you look at the cover of the book, there's a review from Kirkus Reviews that says cinematically grand, and that seems very boastful, but I tell readers, like, I didn't write that review and I didn't put that on the cover. My publisher did. And I do get that. So people are like, well, so? And I will say that my publisher, which is 1016 Press out of Waukesha, Wisconsin, a small local Wisconsin publisher, they are for the first time taking one of their books and shopping it as a movie. So they put together promotional materials and they are sending things out to Hollywood and contacting producers and agents. And we just started that in January, 2 months ago. So we'll see how that goes. We'll see if anyone bites. Lots of authors believe, yes, my book should be a movie. And I'm not so presumptuous to think that this has to be a movie. But my publisher is giving it a try, so we'll see.
As I told you before we went on the air, though, I mean, you couldn't make up a story like this. I mean, if it was a fiction story, people would say, oh, yeah, that's too far out there.
Worried about that. You know, I remember leaving Gene's home after a round of interviews, and my jaw would be on the floor of my car. I'm like, oh, my God. It's like, who's going to believe this? And the way Gene told his story was so matter of fact. You know, he just said, here's what happened. Then we did this. And always humor, always laughing in the most dangerous and dire of situations. There was always humor. And as I did the research after Gene died, it's like, you know, people wonder, well, how much can we take from the memory of an 88-year-old? Quite a bit. You know how it is that older people tend to be very good in certain details about their life. And the research that I did, I was amazed even at his missions. You know, I was able to get the missions from National Archives. You know, things like height that they were flying and dates he was really good about. And so, yeah, the veracity of his stories, I think, often checked. But it is. But I don't think he's the only veteran that had these unbelievable stories. They were unbelievable times. So there's a lot of stories out there.
Right. And again, two other friends very close in Wisconsin that he got to know there and stayed friends with, right?
Yeah. Shorty Sear, Harold, they called him Shorty. Harold Sear from Chippewa Falls and Bill Dorgan from Richland Center were two Wisconsin boys. And that often happened a lot. People would, in prison, when you'd get together with lots of people and you're hungry and you're dirty and you'd shout out states, you'd kind of gather up with your state buddies. And yeah, those three became quite the triumvirate trying to survive POW camp together. And yeah, they remained lifelong friends, though the other two died early. Shorty from Chippewa Falls died in his 50s. And that was in the 1970s. Bill Dorgan died in the 1980s, and he was in his 60s. Both of them had wounds from the war. And I also wonder, too, how much, and I often found this in my research, a lot of those POWs died early deaths. I don't know if their bodies or hearts or their physical conditions were weakened by that POW experience and the death march that they had to participate in, and it caught up with them later. A couple exceptions. One was Gene. I also met a guy from La Crosse that lived in 97 that was in the death march, and also a bomber gunner. So a few exceptions, but most of them tended to die early.
There aren't very many World War II veterans left.
No, but this is going to be hard to believe, but it'll be 2 years this April since the book came out. And in my presentations, I've counted, I think I'm up to 8 World War II veterans I've met.
Really?
Yeah. In La Crosse last spring, I met a 104-year-old guy that survived a kamikaze attack. He was injured in a kamikaze attack. I met a guy that operated a landing craft at D-Day, who just died this past year up in Marshfield. I met a couple other bomber gunners. And I've had a couple guys show up at my presentations in wheelchairs, and they look quite aged. And someone will introduce me to them and say, these are some World War II veterans. So I've met about 8. Yeah, they're still there. They're all about 100 plus right now, but if you get a chance to talk to one of these people, it's like going back in time. You don't miss that opportunity.
What an honor.
Yes.
You've given out a few hugs at your presentations, too.
Oh, yes. I just did last night, and it's oftentimes it'll be siblings that are in their 80s and 90s that lost their brothers to World War II. I've had hugs in that situation. Or people who've said, it was my dad. They never gave up their story, and then they died. And that happens a lot. And then I wish my dad would have shared their story. And also people that, widows and widowers of cancer victims. And because my wife's cancer story is in the story too. So and people always come up to me and say, oh my God, I couldn't put your book down. Or it had me crying 4 or 5 times and I had to put it down. I didn't intend to do that. I didn't intend to write a tearjerker. This is Gene's story, and we're going to tell it the best I can. And yes, I don't want to be so presumptuous to say, but it's life. There's tears and there's jokes. And I think Gene said it best. I didn't write this in the book, but I remember when I restarted the interviews after my wife's death, there was a very poignant moment. We go back to the mobile home, everything as it was, you know, we took a break for about 5-6 months. But there was one difference. He had Gene put a picture up of Gene and my wife hugging, and he put it up on his little shelf where he had family pictures. And I caught that. And it hit a tidal wave of emotions hit me. And I'm trying not to lose it because Gene's sitting right there and he's waiting on me. He knows what's going on. And he just said, John, and I say it in his gravelly voice, life is bittersweet. I didn't write that in the book. And then, because I just thought it was almost too Hollywood, you know, it was like no one's going to believe that. Mm-hmm. He just said, John, life is bittersweet. And I hit the record button on my voice recorder and we went back to work. Mm.
How old are your boys?
Matthew is 25. He is engaged to be married, and he's a police officer in Madison. He graduated with a degree in legal studies from UW-Madison. My other son is 22, and he is graduating with a degree this spring with wildlife ecology and is interviewing for jobs right now. So they're doing all right.
They've turned out all right. Yeah.
Yes.
So my next question, and maybe final question, is there another book for John Umbrister?
I do get that question credit. Right now, no. Tailspin has kept me so busy. Like I said, by June, I will have over 100 appearances. I'm on 80-something right now. But yes, if another story would come along, I'm very intrigued with the Vietnam War. I think those veterans are getting older. Very intrigued also with Vietnamese and Hmong people that came to the United States, that fought for the United States, but lost their home and left a destroyed country. I think there is so much angst, and I think there's so much indecision, mixed emotions about that war. We still struggle with the war. I taught about the Vietnam War for 30 years, and I've seen all kinds of opinions. And veterans themselves don't agree on how to take that war, how to interpret that war. So I'd be very interested in a Vietnam story. Nothing's come up yet. But one of the things I have had people come up and tell me, and Ben Logan faced this with his book, The Land Remembers. People have come up to me and said, you're never going to top this. It's such a unique story. And they're right. It is simply a unique story at a unique time in my life and Gene's life. That will never be, there will never be another Tailspin. And I don't want to sound presumptuous about this. It's just a very unique story. But yeah, I wouldn't mind writing another book in that style, and I'm intrigued with the Vietnam War.
Great. We'll have you on at that time then.
Okay, we'll see.
Well, hopefully before that time, because that'll take a little while.
Yes,
It took a little while to write Tailspin.
It took 11 years to write Tailspin.
My goodness. Community Read coming up at the Brewer Public Library Saturday at 10, featuring Tailspin and our author, John Armbruster. And maybe you've thought of some questions by hearing our conversation today. You're certainly welcome to ask them on Saturday, aren't you,
yes,
John?
Yes, absolutely. I'll stay as long as you want.
Appreciate you coming by today.
You bet, Phil. Thank you very much.
John Armbruster joining us on The Morning Show today from WRCO.